Well, thanks so much for joining us. It is Wednesday morning. Evan Bray, great to have you here. We have had a pretty full week, lots of different guests and topics that we've covered, and it's not ending today. We've got Derek Burney joining us on Friday morning. Derek, of course, chief of staff for a Canadian prime minister, in fact, a chief strategist for both Brian Mulroney and Stephen Harper when they were in government, so looking forward to that. And we've got Canada's Polka King, Walter Ostenick, here tomorrow in studio at noon. And yes, he's bringing his accordion tomorrow at noon. Looking forward to that. All right. Our guest today, Brian Zinchuk, editor and owner of PipelineOnline.ca, Saskatchewan's energy news, joins us for his monthly visit. Brian, you must have danced the odd time to a little polka music from Walter.
Me, never. But my dad, who's over 80, probably danced to it most of his life.
Well, I was going to say, you're from the Yorkton area, so come on, you had to have danced to some good old Walter Ostenick music.
Well, no, I never was much of a dancer, but Dad sure was. And Dad did lots of dancing to polkas. He went to dances every week, so.
Well, I can tell you, my mom, she will be tuning in. She probably doesn't tune in for every segment of the Evan Bray Show, but she will be for that one. She's a big dancer for sure. She'll be all over. Brian, thanks for calling in today. Great to have you on the show. And you've actually got some breaking energy news you're bringing us this morning.
Yeah, I'm even scooping my own webpage here because you're getting it first. So half an hour ago, I walked out of the RM of Weyburn meeting. They had an amendment to a bylaw that passed second and third reading, which allowed for a change in a bylaw to allow the height of wind turbines to be, allowed. What happened was the arm of Weyburn had adopted a bunch of bylaws, basically copy and pasted from the arm of Cormann Park in 2013. They didn't really look at all of it because who's thinking of wind turbines in 2013? And there was a thing in there that said you could only build a wind turbine up to 45 meters. Well, the Enbridge Seven Stars Energy Project, which wants to build a 200-megawatt wind facility just east of Weyburn, where I'm parked right now, that requires 180 meters, four times that height.
Wow.
So anyhow, if Enbridge said last week when they were at a public hearing, they told me if the bylaw did not change, the project is essentially dead.
And I know you've been on this show before talking about, although there's some challenges with wind-produced energy, Enbridge is a pretty important player in this province.
Well, I mean, Enbridge is, one of the biggest players in Canada, never mind this province. Every drop of oil in the southern Saskatchewan flows on Enbridge Pipeline, and they've been in business for over 70 years, so they probably know a little bit about the energy thing. In a related note, I was actually, my lead story today, if you look on the website, pipelineonline.ca, I have a great big in-depth story about the announcement of another wind facility to be built east of Assiniboia, as well as a solar facility to be built south of Cornac. And that's a 200-megawatt and 100-megawatt facilities. And one of the questions I asked at that time was, I pointed out a year and a half ago, I was bugging the Premier about why are we building all this wind and solar. And the Premier said, it's so cheap. Well, so I asked South Power about this, and they said that they won't say exactly what the bids were for that power, but for the Assiniboia project, he said out of the average of the nine bids came in at 6.4 cents per kilowatt hour, and they'll be paying less than that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on your SAS power bill, you as a resident are paying 14 point something cents right now. So 6 cents is pretty cheap when it comes to power.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one of the big motivating factors of why SAS power has been building all this. The arguments I've made a lot are that that's great, but what happens when the wind doesn't blow? But when it does blow, the power is cheap.
And are we able to, we're taking a deeper dive into wind-produced energy than I was expecting, but how are we set up in terms of storing that? So the days where it's not blowing, can we say we've got enough in reserves that we can keep the lights on?
Hardly anything at all. We have a 20-megawatt battery facility built on the east side of Regina. I think it's just off Fleet Street. And that, if you fully charge it up, it can produce power for 1 hour. That's it.
Yeah. So we've got some room to move and grow. So while it may be cheap energy, there's still some infrastructure needed. We're a long ways away from being there.
we are never going to have enough battery capacity to do more than just a little bit for a few minutes. That's the reality.
Brian Zinchuk is my guest, editor and owner of PipelineOnline.ca, Saskatchewan's energy news, breaking the news this morning. I like how you did that. You're in the field right now, right? You're in your truck just outside of Weyburn, breaking the news about the passing of the amendment to the bylaw so that wind project can go. Let's talk oil now. Let's get into discussion on oil. Oil prices not good right now, are they, Brian?
Well, remember I said a few months ago that every time we talk, you can expect the price to go down a little bit?
Yep.
I think we're pretty much bang on the money for that. So the prices as of yesterday, I didn't get a chance to look this morning, but yesterday, Western Texas Intermediate, which is the North American benchmark, was U.S. $59.45. Western Canadian Select was $47.46. And the global Brent crude price was $62.40.
What's the big question is, of course, what's driving that, Brian?
Trump. I mean, the reality is that he's thrown so much chaos into global markets on everything and tariffs and whatnot, is that, that's what's driving prices down. And he said he wanted a lower price. Well, he's getting it.
Mm-hmm. You know, we had a caller actually during open lines today that almost gave you a little bit of a promo saying, you know, you talk to Brian Zinchuk every month, I'm sure he'll tell you oil production is actually declining in the States. Is that true?
Well, so here's the thing. You're seeing a lot more stories, and they're showing up almost every week now, that the Permian Basin, which is West Texas, which 15 years ago was producing 2 million barrels a day, and now it's something like 8 to 10. It's probably getting close to its peak. If it's not its peak, the reality is that stuff needs oil prices higher than what Trump is aiming for to break even. Mm-hmm. So you're likely going to see a decline in activity in that. And the cure for low oil prices, People stop investing money in drilling and activity. What happens is your supply will drop. But more to the point, all the good stuff in West Texas there for the current round, and this has happened every few decades for the last century, for the current round of activity is probably peaking and will go into some sort of decline. We're also seeing, I've seen stuff saying North Dakota could eventually go into decline relatively soon. Wow. So the idea that when Trump says we don't need their energy, he's full of it.
They do need our energy. There's no doubt about that. Brian Zinchuk is my guest. Are we still on a shutdown here? I know we do that spring breakup, I think you call it, every spring while the ground thaws and then hardens enough that the trucks can get back out on the roads.
Yeah, that's correct. So a breakup is just kind of coming to an end now. As of yesterday, we had 4 drilling rigs in the field. At peak times, we get around closer to 40. So we're just starting it going. We got 2 rigs working in northwest Saskatchewan. One just spudded the other day here near Carlisle. And one rig's been working south of Estevan, worked all the way through breakup. That's these multilaterals. They're 40-day wells. They can actually, if they start before breakup starts, they can actually work through 6 weeks that otherwise would be idle and no one's making money. So I anticipate next year we'll see a lot more rigs working through spring breakup. I think that's going to be one of the new things. And for the workers, that's a little bit more money, but maybe a little bit less holidays.
The federal election, since you and I talked, federal election has occurred, and we see the Liberals back in government, another minority. But the landscape did change a little bit. We heard both the Liberals and the Conservatives talk about super energy superpower, energy corridors. Do you have faith? And when I say you, I'm talking about you, Brian, but also people in the business that you talk about, in the oil industry. Is there some faith that the Liberals will follow through with investment in infrastructure and policy that will make us an energy superpower?
Well, from the industry side, I can say that I've seen a lot of sour faces over the last week. I mean, one guy I know who owns an oil service company in southeast Saskatchewan put his house up for sale that day. And that's no joke. He put it up for sale, and he's looking to move to Alberta or the States, but he's done. And I strongly suspect that has a lot to do with the policies of the Liberal government. The timing was no coincidence. As for, do they think that Carney might be better? I think everyone kind of thinks that because how could you be worse than Trudeau? Carney has been talking a good game so far about energy corridors, but you know the proof is going to be when we hear the announcement that he was talking to South Bow here, you know, 2 months from now, and they're looking at building energy east. When that happens, then and only then are we going to see a change in attitude. But that's going to have to happen first, and it's going to have to happen fast, because if you listened to the entire thing, which I ran the verbatim thing of Alberta Premier Daniel Smith talking here on Monday, she had 12 demands. Three of those demands were to build a pipeline to the Pacific coast, to the Arctic coast, and to the East coast.
Yep.
And the other demands were basically, if you don't do this, you know, I'm making it available for my people. If they choose to leave, we'll leave.
I want to dig into that a little bit more. Why don't we take our break, Brian? We'll come back. I want to talk a little bit about some of the messaging we've heard from Premier Danielle Smith. We had Premier Mo on the show yesterday, and he's given us his messaging. And there's some, I would say, some similarities. There's maybe a couple of differences in the way the two premiers are approaching this. So from an oil and gas and energy industry standpoint, I'm curious to know your thoughts. So don't go anywhere. We'll be back with Brian Zinchuk of Pipeline Online here on 980 CJME and 650 CKOM. Welcome back to our discussion with Brian Zinchuk, editor and owner of PipelineOnline.ca. Okay, before we go on, Brian, you started the conversation this morning breaking the news that Weyburn made some changes. They made an amendment to a bylaw to allow that wind energy project that Enbridge has to go ahead. And on text, you sent me a picture that you drew of Weyburn Council.
I used to do courtroom art when I was covering courts and cops in North Balfour to keep myself awake. So,
well, that's impressive. Like, are you going to put that on your webpage?
Yeah, that'll be my lead piece for tomorrow morning.
Okay, well, it's impressive. I'm going to note that you've got a talent there, Brian.
So, getting back to
Brian.
Smith,
Brian says, "Okay, enough with the compliments. Let's get back to the topic at hand." Yes, Danielle Smith.
I really want to beat this one pretty hard here, because I actually enumerated all of her demands. There were 12 of them. The first three were the pipelines I mentioned. And notice that none of these things are saying we need more doctors or we need funding for parks, something like that. Almost every single one of them is energy related. And she's basically saying, you know, fix this or we're walking. So I mentioned the pipelines before. She also said, seeing the federal government end, quote, end all federal interference in the development of provincial resources by repealing the No Pipelines Law, C-69.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of the oil tanker ban. Get rid of the net zero energy regulations. That's the clean energy regulations, or clean electricity regulations, sorry. Get rid of the oil and gas cap. Get rid of the net zero vehicle mandate. That's the thou shalt buy electric cars and not gas cars. Get rid of any federal law or regulation that purports to regulate industrial carbon emissions and plastics. That's the straw law. Commercial free speech of energy companies. That's Bill C-59, which you've heard me talk about at great length.
We've talked about that a lot, yep.
The federal government must refrain from imposing export taxes or restrictions on the export of Alberta resources without consent of the government of Alberta. So in this trade war, you can't put an export tax on our oil or we're going to walk. Alberta, and this is a new one, Alberta to get the same per capita equalization payments that British Columbia, Ontario, and Quebec get. She said that she doesn't have a problem subsidizing the smaller provinces, but why on earth are they subsidizing Quebec?
Which I think we've been saying in Saskatchewan for quite some time as well.
Yes, we have. And if she gets anywhere at that point alone, that will change everything in Confederation, because Alberta basically loses $13 billion in the equalization pot, and Quebec gets $13 billion. And guess what? They have $5 daycare, and we don't out here. So that would change pretty much everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last thing that she said is that she paved the way for a citizen-led referendum. She's saying, I don't support a referendum. I don't want to leave Canada, but if the people of Alberta do, we'll do it. So she's basically laid out the path of how to do that. And you think people aren't going to be signing that petition immediately? She may have her numbers by the end of the
week. I was going to say, I think they're already close to it. I mean, they were over 100,000 signatures. To me, it's a foregone conclusion that when they put forward a few referendum votes in 2026, that vote will be one of them. I mean, just judging by the way it's going, I don't think, though, that it will meet the criteria to even come close to passing. Do you disagree?
I think there'll be a referendum for sure. I don't know if it's going to pass, so you're correct.
Yeah.
We're running short on time here. I did want to get into the Williston Basin Conference.
Oh, yeah. How was that? That was actually during, right after the election in Regina.
Yeah, and I actually posted the entire video of the premier speaking immediately, the first thing in the morning, right after the election. So we talked a bit about that. If you scroll down a little bit, you'll see it on pipelineonline.ca. It was his first chance to talk to anyone after the election. So it's kind of interesting how he talks about it. He's being very conciliatory in working with the new prime minister.
Mm-hmm. That's been consistently his message we've heard, and he was on the show yesterday and he echoed that as well. But it doesn't take away from the fact that Saskatchewan wants to have a voice, wants to be heard, and wants some, much like Alberta, wants our priorities to be recognized federally.
So the conference itself, in previous years, they kind of, you know, started going into some of the other things we're looking at: Saskatchewan, lithium, helium, even hydrogen. And the reality is that the dollars are in oil and gas. So the organizers kind of said, you know, let's get back to basics. And they really, really hammered oil in this thing. And there was a lot more interest. They had, I think, over 400 people there. They had, you know, senior executives and CEOs like John Jeffrey, who I had on my podcast the other day. He was one of the keynote speakers. They had Ken Frum, who's former CEO of Sask Energy. And the geology stuff was really good because there was a lot of talk about the multilaterals. Mm. I mean, a lot of talk and explanation about, you know, how they're working out, and here's some things to look at, and here's different designs, stuff I'd never even seen before. One was a waffle design, which I'd never even seen. So that was really interesting. There was also talk about CO2. If we do rejuvenate coal, and if we have a bunch of CO2 we can inject in for enhanced oil recovery, how much can you get? Now, I did a speech in Calgary 2 weeks ago where my table napkin math said about 80,000 barrels per day incremental production. And Gavin Jensen, that's the grandfather of the lithium industry here in Saskatchewan, his paper, or his presentations, came up with 75,000 barrels. So, you know, he's about 1,000 times smarter than I am, and that's the number he came up with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we do rejuvenate our coal fleet, if we do put carbon capture on it, we could potentially add decades of additional oil production and tens of thousands of barrels if we do that. But that only happens if we rejuvenate our coal fleet.
Brian, as always, we appreciate you stopping by. Thanks for a full half-hour chat, and we look forward to having you back in about a month from now.
Well, I'll see if I can get in town that time.
Good stuff. Brian Zinchuk, editor and owner of PipelineOnline.ca, Saskatchewan's energy news. We always appreciate Brian's take on all things energy in the province. And he scooped the news this morning and talked about the fact that Weyburn, the RM of Weyburn, made the vote to change the bylaw to allow that Enbridge wind energy project to go ahead. Thanks for the chat, Brian. Okay, we take a break. We come back. I want to go back to that Métis hunting rights trial. That was a 2-week trial that just wrapped up on Friday in the province. It actually didn't wrap up for good. There's an adjournment. We'll check in with one of the lead lawyers on that when we come back here on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. We used to sing. Don't forget, Saskatchewan's smartest radio listener. Coming up at 11 o'clock this morning, your chance to prove, is it you? Is this your week? Last week's winner admitted that she's been trying. She gets together with friends every Wednesday at 11 to try and win, and last week was her week, so it could happen to you. SSRL coming up just after 11 o'clock. A couple of weeks ago, we checked in with Kathy Hodgson-Smith. She is a lawyer that's involved in a big trial that began in the province, determining to what extent Métis people have hunting and fishing rights in Saskatchewan protected under the Canadian Charter, known as the Section 35 Charter Rights, which First Nations people in Saskatchewan and Canada have. Métis hunting and fishing rights are an issue that the province and Métis people have long held different perspectives on. And really, there has been back and forth in the courts. There's been a few carve-outs in certain areas of not just Saskatchewan, but the Prairie provinces, but nothing definitive has been figured out yet. So the trial went on for a couple of weeks, and this is a final decision that will potentially be significant for Métis people going forward. trial is actually adjourned right now. It will resume in almost a year from now, which seems like a long time. Here to help us break it apart and understand what happened, Kathy Hodgson-Smith, lead counsel at Presido LLP. She is one of the lawyers in the courtroom for this, and Kathy joins us this morning. Kathy, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
This is a pretty important trial. Maybe give us just a bit of a recap of what this trial, what is at the heart of this? What's at stake in this trial?
So this is a trial where the Métis are claiming that they had a sufficient presence by 1870 here in Saskatchewan that continues to this day as part of a highly mobile way of life, and that as part of this lifestyle, they hunted, fished, trapped, and gathered for food. Now, we have court rulings on the issue of where Métis can hunt, fish, trap, and gather for food in Saskatchewan already. We have the Morne and Dyal case from 1996, where the courts found as a fact that the Métis were had a sufficient presence in northwest Saskatchewan, you know, as early as the early 1800s. In Laviolette, it was confirmed that the Métis were present in the historic northwest, which is essentially Saskatchewan, Alberta, Manitoba, and parts around the edge, by 1870 in the Meadow Lake, Green Lake area. Then we have the Bellamer case that said the court found as a fact that the Métis were present in all of southern Saskatchewan and Manitoba before effective European control. And then we have the Goudon case, which said the Métis were present in the historic northwest all the way to Russell, Manitoba, which is by Yorkton on the Saskatchewan side. Mm-hmm. So essentially the bottom third of Manitoba are larger before effective control. So the question for the court here is looking at three new hunters and fishermen who were hunting in Yorkton and south of Meadow Lake by Elcott Creek and at fishing at Chittick Lake, whether those men were hunting and fishing within a territory that Section 35 rights could be found. So it will save us a lot of time if we could get a final answer to this question rather than doing it person by person.
And that's where I was just going to go, Kathy, is at what point, I remember the last time we talked, I think you used the term patchwork quilt. I mean, this is really what's happened is we've had findings, as you've just illustrated, in parts of Saskatchewan, parts of Alberta, Manitoba. Is there a point in which a ruling comes down that gives rights to Métis people in the province, carte blanche, covered under Section 35 as Indigenous people, First Nations people have?
Well, that is the opportunity, I guess, that the Court of Appeal set for us to discuss in this case. The Court of Appeal found in reviewing all these other decisions that while there were large tracts of land, you know, that were recognized as areas where the Métis could hunt and fish, that in the end, the decision would narrow it down into a very specific location closer to where they were actually hunting and fishing. And the court said there's no requirement to do that. The case law from the Supreme Court of Canada says you don't have to worry about the boundaries between provinces. They're not relevant to looking at Section 35. You don't even have to look at the American boundary when you're asking the question of where were the Métis historically. And so in this case, we're hoping the court will take a large look now and say, if we look at the places in between, is there sufficient presence in those places to ground a Section 35 right?
What are the tests, Kathy? What are the tests? What are the questions that you're looking to have answered, the tests that need to be met in order to get a favorable ruling?
So Section 35 of the Constitution preserves and respects the fact that Indigenous people were here in Canada in their various traditional lands before European control. And so any laws that were built up after that, unless they clearly and plainly extinguished those Aboriginal rights, those rights continue to today. So the question is, where were the Métis people historically? And, you know, I think the courts have generally accepted that the Métis are a people, that the historic Métis Nation or the Red River Métis, that they are a distinct collective identity. And the question becomes, in which geographic area were they living together, sharing a common way of life? And so the test goes, where was the historic community? What was their way of life? And is this an essential part of that way of life, hunting, fishing, trapping, gathering for food? And those questions, I think, have historically been answered. So where were they historically, and where are they today? Was there a continuous presence to today in Saskatchewan, Alberta, Manitoba, for example? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there was, were they sufficiently present before effective European control? And then if those questions are answered favorably to the Métis hunter who was hunting for food, then the question then becomes, are these hunters that are before the court, are they descendants of that community, and were they hunting within the territory that that historic community hunted?
So the trial lasted for the better part of 2 weeks. What were some of the testimonies that were highlighted throughout that time?
So we focused the first 2 weeks on the present use of the Métis. So there were about 25 people testified from across the province about, you know, their own identity, their cultural traditions, the traditions of their family, where they lived and where they exercised this right, and who they're genealogically connected to. And so we've kind of covered off now the contemporary side. And as you know, this case is also not retrying everything that we tried in the first trial of Hutra and Boyer. We brought all that evidence in from the first trial by consent, and there were a number of community witnesses who testified in Hutra 1. We're also bringing evidence of people that have now passed from the cases of Bellamer, which is the southern Saskatchewan trial where the court found the Métis had Section 35 rights in the Qu'Appelle Valley and environs, including Regina. So many community witnesses testified there, and we're bringing those transcripts into this trial, as well as the Grumbo case, and that was a case on the issue of the Natural Resources Transfer Agreement. Now, all of that evidence is coming in by consent, so we think perhaps for a few people that were missed, that might be the end of our community, modern community evidence.
Mm-hmm. So we're in a bit of an adjournment now, and I say a bit, it's actually about a year. Why is that necessary, Kathy?
We had originally set the 3 weeks aside to do the whole trial, perhaps a bit ambitious, but nonetheless, we did make it also a decision in the interim to add a third hunter into the mix. So we're essentially running three trials together. So we have now got an adjournment to allow for the historic evidence to come in. And that is the historic experts who will testify to where were the Métis when, what was their involvement in Canada's fur trade, what did the lifestyle look like, and then, you know, decisions made by Canada historically that moved the Métis from one place to another, and how sort of Canadian policy affected that. So all of those experts are going to come together. We've got an adjournment week of February 9th to the 13th of 2026, continuing on March 23rd to April 2nd of 2026. And in that time frame, we will run all of defense expert evidence as well as Crown expert evidence.
Is there a worry, Kathy, that you lose momentum when you have a long adjournment like that?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, Warren Boyer and Oliver Putra have been carrying this issue for a very long time, more than 10 years. And so it's a bit grueling. Of course, the judge takes good notes and has all of the transcripts of the other trials. you know, the evidence of Laviolette is coming in by consent. So there's a lot of work, you know, for the trial judge to do in the meantime. So I think in this case, we'll be able to manage the lengthy adjournment request and provide time for the sharing of these reports, which are often very content-heavy and complex.
Mm-hmm.
It is a long time away, but we're really looking forward to finishing things off.
This is, it's important, and it's an important trial, and Kathy, we very much appreciate now you checking in with us a couple of times. We will definitely connect with you again as the trial fires up in 2026 and look forward to watching this through conclusion.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Kathy Hodgson-Smith, lead counsel at Presidio, who is representing the Métis people that are in the heart of this trial, and of course it goes well beyond just the two or three people that are involved in this. It is really about the path forward and being covered under Section 35 of the Canadian Charter for Métis people in Saskatchewan when it comes to hunting and fishing rights. You're listening to 980 CJME and 650 CKOM. Good morning, Evan Bray. Great to have you here on a Wednesday morning. If you were out and about this morning in Saskatoon and you saw the large plume of smoke that was coming from the north end, you were no doubt following closely what was going on there. The WD Plastics business on 56th Street East, the scene of a significant fire this morning. CKOM reporter Alex Brown was at the scene. Alex joins us in studio this morning. Alex, thanks for popping in.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
So what did you get? You were out on scene there. Pretty significant fire this morning.
Yeah, it was a devastating scene, to be sure. So as soon as I approached the North Industrial area of Saskatoon, you could see that thick black smoke. I mean, you couldn't miss it. So you knew this was a big deal before you even arrived on scene. So this was 56th and Cleveland, so an industrial area. There's a lot of businesses along that street. WD Plastics was the one that was on fire, the building. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a family-owned business, Evan, that has been around for decades. I mean, a lot of people in Saskatoon know who these folks are. They won the Business Builder Award from the NSBA Awards in 2022. They were in high demand during the COVID pandemic, providing plexiglass shields to Sask Tel Center and to other places. But they do so much more than that. And so upon arriving this morning, I got there just before 6. And I got there the same time as the family. And so the first thing that happened was, as I was getting out of my car trying to get my bearings, I saw one of the family members just drop to the ground, tears, yeah. Obviously, you know, holding her face in her hands. Mm. And so I approached and just said, hey, like, at first I didn't know it was the family. And right. So I just went like, hey, like, do you guys know what's happening mm-hmm. here? And she said, this is my family's business. This is ours. And no, we don't know. And I said, okay, like, you guys take all the time you need. So while on scene, you know, this is a big operation. This isn't yeah. one or two trucks. This is 6 trucks. They're calling for backup. This is 2 ladders. They're bringing in the mobile command center. They're bringing in vehicles to deal with the toxic. It's plastic. So
right.
It's quite
I
toxic.
Was thinking about that. There would yeah. be toxins coming from that.
Definitely. And so you can just tell, like, they pushed us back, like media and the family, further back about a block away because there were more and more units coming from all sides. So right away, I noticed that there was flames, clearly. The roof was gone. They were spraying through the window. They had the ladders up. Now, I just spoke with Deputy Chief Rob Hogan at a press conference in the parking lot. They were actually taking a break for an hour while they reset and do some shift change. And he said that, unfortunately, there's 40-kilometer winds, and it's just not safe for firefighters to be up really high on those ladders. And they're kind of having to regroup because it's still on fire. They haven't put out the fire.
I was just going to say, we've only got about a minute left, Alex. So mm-hmm. the fire is not yet fully contained? Is there still is there a danger to other businesses in the area?
That's their main focus. They want to keep it contained to the area and they don't want it to spread. And it sounds like that is going to be the case. It is very protected. It's quite a large building. They have engines on all sides. Firefighters have not been able to enter the structure is the other part of this. It was too unstable, too dangerous. The good news is that no one was inside at the time of the fire. They don't have a cause. They don't know what started this. It was overnight when no one was working. So no one really knows what happened.
Alex, I appreciate you giving us this update. Thanks for following along, and we'll continue to watch developments in this as they unfold.
Thank you so much, Evan.
CKOM reporter Alex Brown following the significantly large fire at WD Plastics 56th Street East in Saskatoon. No injuries, but devastating to the business. And our newsroom continues to follow this story. Saskatchewan's smartest radio listener coming up next here on 980 CJME and 650 CKOM.